holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meetings policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Finance Committee meets the fourth Monday of every month at 4:30 p.m.
Good morning. It's 8:59. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming right up at the top of the hour, it's Political Perspectives presenting Sojourner Truth Radio, a roundtable discussion on Trump's racist language, workfare for Medicaid, and a preview of the 2018 midterm elections are among the topics covered today. At 10 o'clock, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And then at 11 o'clock, it's time for the food show this month with host Chris Siegel, who assures me he'll be live today. And remember, please, that KABU keeps you informed, and you can be an owner down here and get involved. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate to become a member.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today on our weekly roundtable, Donald Trump admits to using strong language in a meeting with bipartisan senators on immigration. He reportedly referred to Haiti and Africa as S-hole countries. You might note I cannot quote the president's reported language. None of us on Pacifica can, because due to a Supreme Court ruling versus Pacifica, we are prohibited from saying seven words on the air, including one of the words that Trump supposedly used. Now, Donald Trump is saying he did not use that specific language, but he says he used strong language, and he's not really spelling out exactly what he said. We will be discussing all of this on our roundtable, and also Kumi Naidu will be joining us. He is the executive director of Africans Rising, specifically for that segment. We are also going to be discussing other issues related to immigration, a lot going on right now with a deal on Dreamers on the line. We're not quite sure what will happen with that. Also, the 2018 midterms coming up. Can Democrats take the House or the House and the Senate? What are the hot spots? And Trump is proposing workfare for Medicaid. Our panelists are Jackie Goldberg, Laura Carlson, and Dr. Gerald Horn. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
President Trump says, quote, "This was not the language used," after reports that he referred to Haitian and African nations as S-holes in a meeting. Trump tweeted today amid criticism over his comments during a White House meeting Wednesday. The White House has not denied the language, nor have the several Republican lawmakers in the meeting. Three people briefed on this conversation say Trump questioned why the U.S. would accept more immigrants from Haiti and, quote, S-hole countries in Africa. The United Nations human rights chief and several Democratic lawmakers condemned the statement. Vermont Independent Senator Bernie Sanders told CNN the remarks contradict the lessons people try to teach their children.
Judge people based on their character. Don't judge people based on the color of their skin or the country that they came from, whether or not they have an accent or not. Judge them on whether they are good human beings. And we have a president today, the leader of our nation, telling the whole world that that's not what he does.
A senior Trump administration official says the top U.S. diplomat in Haiti has been summoned to meet with Haiti's president to explain the president's remark about immigrants. Robin Diallo, the chargé d'affaires at the U.S. embassy, is the most senior diplomat there, as the Trump administration does not have an ambassador in place. The administration official says Diallo plans to listen to the Haitian leader's concerns and reiterate the strong U.S. relationship with Haiti. President Trump has canceled a trip to London, where he had been expected to open the new $1 billion U.S. embassy, avoiding protests promised by political opponents. Some British lawmakers questioned whether Trump would be welcome after he retweeted videos from a far-right British group and criticized London Mayor Sadiq Khan following a terror attack last year. But Trump said his decision, announced in a late-night tweet, was due to the president's concerns about what he called a bad real estate deal related to the move. Trump blamed President Obama for the move, but it was actually President Bush who approved the new embassy. While the date of a Trump visit had never been confirmed, speculation suggested the president would formally open the embassy at a ceremony next month. London Mayor Sadiq Khan tweeted, quote, "It appears that President Trump got the message from the many Londoners who love and admire America and Americans, but find his policies and actions the polar opposite of our city's values of inclusion, diversity, and tolerance." Prime Minister Theresa May has extended an invitation to Trump for a state visit later this year. He's reportedly accepted, but no date has been set. And President Trump will undergo a full physical today at the Walter Reed Medical Hospital near Washington. It's his first medical checkup as president. But what has been a fairly routine exam for previous office holders has taken an outsized importance in the age of Trump, given the debate about his fitness for office that intensified following publication of an insider's account of Trump's first year as president. Trump has pushed back hard against any suggestion that he's mentally unfit, declaring himself, quote, "a very stable genius." A Bangladeshi immigrant still recovering from injuries suffered in the failed pipe bombing of the New York subway system pleaded not guilty to terrorism charges Thursday. Akayed Ullah entered the plea after he was indicted a day earlier on charges he provided material support to a terrorist organization and used a weapon of mass destruction. The 27-year-old Ullah was the only person seriously hurt when the bomb went off December 11th in a corridor linking the subway to Manhattan's Port Authority bus terminal. Authorities believe he self-radicalized after entering the U.S. 7 years ago. He claimed he was acting on behalf of the Islamic State group. The Los Angeles County supervisors are backing a change in state law to allow paramedics to take homeless individuals to a sobering center or other treatment facility rather than the emergency room. Pacifica's Larry Buell reports.
The discussion evolved from a proposal to move forward with setting up homeless outreach service teams, called HOSTs, in city police departments. The LA County Board approved $1 million in funding for those teams in June. The money will go directly to smaller law enforcement agencies willing to work with private partners that connect homeless people to services, like mental health and substance abuse treatment and housing. Supervisor Catherine Barger asked for more data on 911 calls and how the homeless crisis is affecting county police and fire departments.
The individuals who interact most are our first responders, and I think it's important for us to partnership with them, because I know there's a push to not make homelessness about criminalization, but about actually offering assistance and help.
Under current state laws, paramedics can only take patients to an emergency room. Supervisor Janice Hahn said legislation giving EMS teams more flexibility was in the works, but she anticipated a fight in Sacramento. Emergency room doctors and nurses are opposed to the idea. Larry Buell, Pacifica Radio, KPFK, Los Angeles.
And I'm Max Pringle. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio.
And this is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth, and of course, news outlets across the world carrying Trump's racist and derogatory terms in describing Haiti and African countries. Of course, today marks the anniversary of the devastating earthquake in Haiti that killed hundreds of thousands of people, injured even more. Now, the New York Times is reporting that Trump on Thursday refused to back in a bipartisan immigration deal that would have included protections for people from Haiti and some of the nations in Africa. And the New York Times is reporting that Trump demanded to know why he should accept immigrants from S-hole countries rather than from places like Norway. And again, for our guests, I'll remind them that because Pacifica lost a lawsuit all that went all the way up to the Supreme Court, we cannot use the S word on air on Pacifica. We are prohibited by the U.S. Supreme Court. Now, Trump had earlier referred to Haiti, saying that they all had AIDS. He said Nigerians would never go back to their huts. He, of course, denied making the statement. But interestingly enough, the New York Times is reporting that after this story broke on Thursday, before midnight, shortly before midnight, sent this tweet out, quote, "The Democrats seem intent on having people and drugs pour into our country from the southern border, risking thousands of lives in the process. It is my duty to protect the lives and safety of all Americans." And then he goes on to say, "We must build a great wall." Now, the president on Thursday met with senators, Republican Senator Lindsey Graham, Republican of South Carolina, and Richard J. Durbin, a Democrat of Illinois. Now, no one has said, I think it's assumed that perhaps this was the meeting where this language took place. Before we welcome our guests, let us go to a clip one from the Washington Post, really matching up Trump's alleged comment with his past statements on immigrants, and then a short piece of Anderson Cooper of CNN talking about Haiti.
President Trump is attracting quite a bit of attention today, and especially criticism, for allegedly asking, why are we having all these people from countries come here? He was in the middle of some conversations with lawmakers looking for bipartisan deals to address multiple immigration issues, which have been on the table for much of this week following decisions made about immigrants coming from El Salvador, Haiti, and other countries who come to the States seeking temporary protection. This is perhaps the latest alleged comment coming from those in the White House about how the president frames how he talks about people, specifically of color, from countries that send immigrants and or refugees to the United States.
When Mexico sends its people, they're not sending their best.
It's important to remember that when President Trump announced his campaign for the presidency, on that day, he called Mexican immigrants rapists and murderers.
They're bringing drugs, they're bringing crime, they're rapists, and some, I assume, are good people.
When I've interviewed people about comments the president has made about immigrants, they have feigned no shock and no surprise because of what he said on the campaign trail, referencing a poem suggesting that immigrants were snakes.
Oh, shut up, silly woman, said the reptile with a grin. You knew damn well I was a snake before you took me in.
Suggesting that they were criminals very early on in his race for the White House, claiming that they could be eventually members of ISIS, when specifically talking about refugees from Syria.
When I'm elected president, we will suspend the Syrian refugee program. Have no choice. And we will keep radical Islamic terrorists the hell out of our country, believe me.
And just, of course, wanting to ban certain immigrants from certain countries, not because of their faith, but it certainly seemed to appear that the immigrants that he spoke most aggressively about did happen to be non-Christians.
Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States
until our country's representatives can figure out what the hell is going on.
So it appears to be a clear difference in how the president speaks about immigrants from predominantly white countries and immigrants from countries that are primarily populated by people of color or religious minorities.
The people of Haiti have been through more. They've been through more. They withstood more. They fought back against more injustice than our president ever has. Tomorrow marks exactly 8 years since the earthquake struck Haiti. A 7.1 magnitude earthquake killed anywhere between 220,000 and 300,000 people. The actual numbers will never be known because they were buried in unmarked pits. 1.5 million people were displaced. For days and weeks, without help from their own government or police, the people of Haiti dug through rubble with their bare and bloodied hands to save complete strangers, guided only by the cries of the wounded and the dying. I was there when a young girl named Bee, who'd been trapped in rubble for nearly a day, was rescued by people who had no heavy equipment. They just had their God-given strength and their determination and their courage. I was there when a 5-year-old boy named Monley was rescued after being buried for more than 7 days. Do you know what strength it takes to survive on rainwater buried under concrete, a 5-year-old boy buried for 7 days? Haitians slap your hand hard when they shake it. They look you in the eye. They don't blink. They stand tall, and they have dignity. It's a dignity many in this White House could learn from. It's a dignity the president, with all his money and all his power, could learn from as well. On the anniversary of the earthquake, on this day when this president has said what he has said about Haitians, we hope the people in Haiti who are listening tonight in Port-au-Prince, in Jacmel, in Benet, in Miami, and elsewhere, we hope they know that our thoughts are with them and that our love is with them as well.
Yeah, and there you heard in the first part of this clip, Eugene Scott of the Washington Post. And then that last voice, of course, a very emotional Anderson Cooper, who is an anchor on CNN. Now, I'd like to welcome, to kick off our discussion on all of this, Kumi Naidu, who is a South African human rights activist, prominent anti-apartheid campaigner. He currently serves as the launch director of Africans Rising and was formerly the international executive director of Greenpeace. Kumi, welcome back.
Thank you very much.
So, Kumi, your response to this and also what you're picking up on the continent reacting to Trump's comments.
Well, firstly, let me just say that the words we just heard were absolutely spot on. And the outrage that has been generated since it has been leaked is justified. In fact, it should be amplified a million times over. We, as Africans Rising for Justice, Peace and Dignity, endorse the United Nations Human Rights Commission's statement today, which declared the actions from President Trump absolutely racist. We also note that for many countries around the world, the majority of countries around the world today, if their head of state, if their president or prime minister said something of such objectionable public taste, that they would actually be impeached and pushed out of office, or would have had come under pressure and show some dignity and resign. I think that this is extremely hurtful for millions of people, hundreds of millions of people around the continent, and for dignity-loving people anywhere, to have these sentiments coming out from the top of the American political establishment. And I hope that the majority of American people stand up at this moment and show extreme outrage at this blatant racism that's been uttered in the last hours of the last days.
Right. And Kumi, I know you have to dash, and we want to introduce our roundtable. They are listening to your comments. What about the reaction from heads of state on the continent. We know that a number of heads of state, of course, have relationships with Washington, are very, you know, dependent on aid and also other colonial powers. I mean, France decided that they're not going to comment on it at all, which I thought was pretty outrageous, actually, especially given the comments on Haiti, but not only France's role on the continent. So tell us a bit about that. What are you hearing?
Yeah, well, firstly, let me just say that we all have an option here to be part of the problem or part of the solution. Silence and indifference is a choice to actually be part of the problem. So the French leadership, we would say, not coming out and condemning it is absolute cowardice on your part and is not in line with the sentiments of the French people. Secondly, in terms of comments so far, most of our heads of state are in a bit of a state of shock. They're trying to reflect on how do they respond, and they have, as you correctly pointed out, Margaret, the limitations of having aid packages and so on, which are already under threat, being threatened further by statements of criticism. Having said that, as part of African civil society, we would urge our governments on the continent in the next 24 hours, as well as the African Union, as our collective identity, to come out with a strong and a scathing comment to criticize what has been said. So far, it's been muted, and I think there is concern if individual countries speak out loudly, they would be very vulnerable to U.S. economic and political pressure. But I think if they all were to speak out and the African Union speaks out, it will send a strong message. And we want to be very clear as Africans that, you know, it's not as if it's a one-way relationship here. Africa is not a poor continent. It's the richest continent underneath the ground, and precisely for that reason, one of the poorest continents above the ground. And so what we would say is that the United States economy has been a beneficiary of African oil and African resources. People would not have cell phones if not for a rare earth material called coltan that comes out of the Democratic Republic of Congo and so on. So let's be very clear. Africa has many, many challenges. True, our leaders let us down far too often, but to be described almost a billion people in the manner that he has done is not only disrespectful to us, it's also disrespectful to himself and whoever who thinks that they are supporters of them, of Trump, because it's the language and the level of discourse in the United States drops down to this level. It's tragic, given that we have many challenges to face together as humanity in terms of climate change, in terms of deepening inequality, and so on. And to have these continuous ill-advised side shows going on where you criticize an entire continent and of course Haiti and other countries as well is completely unacceptable, and I hope that the people of the United States stand up against this. I hope that the African leaders stand up against this, and I hope that decent people everywhere say enough is enough and no more.
Right. Well, Kumi Naidu, thank you so very much. And we hope to be speaking with you again soon, perhaps next week, as we continue our series on the movements that you are so integral to coming up, particularly among young people on the continent of Africa. Thank you, Kumi.
Thank you.
All righty. And of course, Kumi, I'm looking at an article by Quartz saying Apple and Tesla need cobalt for their future. So does Volkswagen. So again, the dependence on the resources under the ground in Africa. I'd now like to welcome our roundtable panelists. And let's see how much of what we want to talk about that we'll be able to get through. I'd like to welcome Laura Carlson, political analyst and writer. writer based in Mexico. She's written extensively on NAFTA, the drug war, immigration, gender issues, and a number of outlets. She's a columnist also for a number of outlets, including Huffington Post, Al Jazeera, BBC, and she has participated as an analyst and activist in the movement against militarization and the drug war on both sides of the border, as the host of the Mexican TV program, Hecho en America. Laura, welcome.
Thanks, Margaret. Good morning.
And Jackie Goldberg, who served in the California State Assembly, also on the Los Angeles City Council. She served on the Los Angeles School Board and as president of the school board. And she's currently working on contract with Mayor Garcetti's office to help hire some permanent city employees, restoring service cut off or curtailed by the layoffs. Jackie Goldberg has been an educator all of her life. Jackie, welcome.
Thank you for inviting me. Nice to be with you.
And Dr. Gerald Horn, Moore's Professor of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston, written more than 30 books, including three new books soon to be released, Facing the Rising Sun, African Americans, Japan, and the Rise of Afro-Asian Solidarity. Also, The Apocalypse of Settler Colonialism, The Roots of Slavery, White Supremacy, and Capitalism in 17th Century North America and the Caribbean. And also, Storming the Heavens, African Americans, and the Early Fight for the Right to Fly. Laura Carlson, let's start with you, because these comments and Trump's weak denial, it's a denial, but not really a denial, right? And also, the White House yesterday also did not deny that Trump actually made those comments. All of this within the context of the negotiation going on now around immigration. But just your reaction, Laura Carlson, to all of this.
It's clear that he did make these comments, and they are totally in line with the comments that he's made before that people have that the clip that you played reminds us. It is, I can completely understand why the clip was so emotional in talking about Haitians. It's very emotional. It's emotional when you think about the refugees and the migrants and the kinds of challenges that these people face as they make the very difficult and dangerous decision to come to the United States. And it's emotional and absolutely outrageous when you consider that many of those challenges and problems that they're facing in their home countries are caused or at least contributed to by U.S. policy. And then there's this kind of response. In Latin America, by extension, and in the case of El Salvador explicitly, he is also referring to most Latin American countries, and Mexico implicitly, and as I say, El Salvador was in the list as asshole countries. And there has been an outraged response here, although, as was pointed out in the case of Africa, not as indignant or as strong as it should be in this case. This is a really a black and white case of racism and brown. As the UN spokesman said, there's no other word one can use but racist. You cannot dismiss entire countries and continents as assholes whose entire populations who are not white are therefore not welcome. And this is exactly what's happening and what's happened with Trump's immigration policy all the way along. The White House came back with a statement that, well, we're all about America first. It was weak. It was insulting by not even slightly condemning the type of language and the context behind it that the president used. And this has been, of course, slammed in papers across the country. In Latin America, the response, again, because of the power and the economic dependency on the United States, El Salvador came out responding that we're good people and we helped rebuild New Orleans. These countries don't have to defend their people in front of this kind of comments from a madman in the White House. They just have to say this is absolutely unacceptable in any type of a diplomatic relationship or in any type of a human relationship. So we have to figure out, too, what can we do that goes beyond criticizing and acting justifiably outraged? And that's where the immigration debate comes down as well. He's been completely, he's been ambiguous. He's been ambivalent in this debate. And in the last indication is that he's digging in. He's now completely attached the wall to the DACA court decision, and the whole conservative press machinery is going behind that kind of a deal. But what we underestimate is the cost of adopting this logic that we need more boots and bricks on the U.S.-Mexico border in order to, to give 700,000 young people their lives back. When we buy into that false idea of migrants as a threat, we're again contributing to the language and the concepts that have led to this kind of racism seeming acceptable to so many people. So as long as they say, okay, we'll give you DACA if you'll give us the $18 billion wall and a bunch of other supposedly border security things, we're just continuing the perception, this false perception of migrants as a threat, and we're going to continue to feed into this minority base of Trump supporters that thinks that it's okay to be racism, that thinks that it's okay to destroy lives and many of the principles that the United States was built on.
Yes, and thank you, Laura Carlson. You know, Jackie Goldberg, the White House spokesperson, Raj Shah, didn't deny that S-hole remark, and neither did Trump in the tweet that he sent out last night, but seemed to underscore it by talking about Democrats seeming to have people and drugs pour from our country from the southern border, right? So that we know exactly who he's talking about there. And, you know, it seemed to me as though the only thing he could really do is to not fully deny it, but to say, well, I sort of said something like that, but it wasn't exactly those words. I wonder maybe it was even worse. But Jackie Goldberg, your comment on that, and also the concern by some progressive Democrats that that some of the more blue dog Democrats are ready to make a deal, some concessions on the wall, and I don't know what else with Trump to get some protections with DACA. But even that Trump seems to be, balking at. So Jackie Goldberg, put this in some your comments on this, including the context, the wider context of the message that Trump is sending, not only to people in the United States, but to people around the world.
Well, many of us have said from the beginning that make America great again really meant make America white again. And that white and great in the Trump mind and his colleagues and his supporters are the same word. You make America great again by making America white again. This all relates to the fact that there are a very growing number of white Americans who fear that somehow or another, as the country becomes more diverse, and as we end up with a country which will no longer have a majority white population at some point very soon, that they will have done to them what they have done to people who of color. I think that's the underlying fear of all of this. What's happening, however, is that we're seeing him actually take actual actions to try to return people to countries they've never lived in as children. So they never grew up in the countries they're going to be sent back to. They don't speak the languages. They don't understand what's going on. And he is interested in having skilled workers come to the United States. Well, I know I live in California. I suppose that the farm owners of California are not real happy about this because already they're suffering from a shortage of farm workers already. And with this kind of kicking out of Salvadorans, kicking out Haitians, kicking out people from Nicaragua, kicking out young people who have been a part of making their lives here and doing extremely well in their lives, all of that is a part of a general conversation that Trump was having in the White House. What were they talking about? They were talking about temporary protected status. And why does he want to end that? He wants to end that because this is a part of his goal of deporting 12 million people who are here without papers. I think all of this is being orchestrated in fact. But I think the real winner of Trump's comments was China. China has been heavily trying to make inroads into its importance to African states. It's done dam projects, it's done other kinds of roads and trains and construction. And I think that if you have a choice now, if you're in an African nation, between looking at some kind of relationship to China or some type of relationship to the United States, these kinds of comments say, well, let's pick somebody who at least likes us and doesn't think that we're all asshole countries, or that we're all living in huts, or that all of us have AIDS, or that all of us are drug addicted, or drug importers, or drug cartels. I mean, this is a view of the world that says that basically white Europe is good and everything else is bad. And that we should not let people from those other nations, those non-white nations, into this country. I think what you do when you do that is not only upset all of the people in the United States who care about the fact that it is, in fact, the most important thing that made America great has been in immigration, that's really been the what changed this country from other countries is our immigration status and allowing people in who have been affected by earthquakes, as was El Salvador, or by interventions by the United States in their politics. So what you have basically is that a president of the United States questioning why the United States should take in unskilled laborers from countries instead of welcoming immigrants from nations that can offer skilled workers. Well, that's never been our rule. It's never been how we do it, and I think that you will see that the big, big, big winner in all of this whole debate right now is going to be China.
Yes, thank you for that, Jackie Goldberg. And Dr. Horn, it seems to me, just looking at the broader picture here, that this clearly is about immigration, but it's about more than immigration. I mean, Trump has repeatedly said that he is an embodiment of what the United States stands for. And that has been a tough pill to swallow for many liberals and many good-meaning people in this country, despite the history of genocide and slavery, et cetera, the United States, Jim Crow, and more, who really don't want to face a kind of entrenched racism in the United States that, okay, sometimes it comes in waves. You have some people that voted for Obama who are now Trump supporters, but that, you know, pushing that racist button is one that those in power can depend on to maintain the status quo. So what does Trump indeed represent? And your comments about all of this, Dr. Horn.
I think this episode reveals and exposes that Donald J. Trump, sadly and unfortunately, understands the majority of the nation defined as white better than some of his detractors. Beyond the denunciation of Donald J. Trump, which must go forward, we must also ask the question, why does this satisfy his base, which is what we are being told in certain quarters? Why does this satisfy a base of 63 million voters? Why is it that a few weeks ago, as Congress was debating tax cuts for the 1%, Mr. Trump, in a similar fashion, issued tweets that were Islamophobic in nature, which was supposedly designed to satisfy his base? Why does bigotry satisfy his base? And I think that's the question you're driving at, Margaret. I think that many are upset, particularly some of our liberal friends, with Trump, not necessarily because of his statements, but because he has unmasked the true nature of the United States and has disrupted illusions that many would prefer to hold. I think that this episode helps us to force an analysis away from Donald J. Trump as an individual, as horrible as he is, to the United States as a nation, and I think that there are those who are reluctant to go there. I think that that also exposes how the U.S. left has lagged in its analysis of racism. You have many leading U.S. left intellectuals and politicos who never say a mumbling word about racism, even though you have people of color being shot down on the street by the police like dogs on a regular basis. And sadly, some of the most insightful analyses of racism can be found in the corporate media, not on the left media. I'm thinking of Charles Blow of the New York Times and Paul Krugman of the New York Times, who are consistently insightful on this question, unlike some of our left-wing friends. And I think that if we began to dig deep, we'd even have to go beyond Blow and Krugman, who, despite their positive qualities, never dig deeply into the nature of settler colonialism, the fact the United States was founded in reaction to the Royal Proclamation of 1763 that sought to prevent settlers from moving west, seizing Native Americans' land, and Somerset's case in England in 1772, which seemed to foretell the abolition of slavery, which would have jeopardized the fortunes of the founding fathers, including George Washington himself. And it's no accident that when the United States was forced to move away from the more egregious aspects of Jim Crow in the 20th century, you had mass riots amongst those defined as white, be it as in Little Rock in 1957, Oxford, Mississippi in 1962-63, Boston in the 1970s, Yonkers, New York in the 1980s. And it's no accident that this Make America Great Again not only suggests Make America White Again, but also it portends, if we're not careful, a leap from Jim Crow, returning to that horror, into fascism. So I think that if we're really to be honest with regard to how we approach this question, we're really going to have to deepen our analysis, and we're also going to have to learn the lessons of the past, which is to overturn slavery and Jim Crow, and perhaps even this fascism that is now being portended by Mr. Trump. We're really going to have to organize internationally, and this attack on Africa in particular opens up that door.
Right. Thank you, Dr. Gerald Horn. And I have to say, I mean, remembering that today marks the anniversary of the horrific earthquake that happened in Haiti, that I sometimes have to take our friends on the left to task when it comes to Haiti. I had a programmer in Los Angeles say, well, why are you focusing, you know, so much coverage on Haiti? That country has been a mess for a long time. Well, that's a kind of a version of Donald Trump's remarks. And with the U.S. coups and intervention in Haiti, or even when I try to fundraise, you know, for Haiti, for people on the ground, the response is kind of very lean. And somehow there seems to be a kind of a confusion on Haiti that I think has something to do with race and racism. So, Dr. Horn, there isn't time to go more into that now. Sojourner Truth listeners know that we do regular coverage on Haiti, but it is just outrageous. If Donald Trump didn't say S-hole, which I believe he did, he probably said a whole lot more than that. And that's the only piece that people are ready to leak to the press. But on that note, we're going to have to leave it there and take our station break. And when we return, workfare for Medicaid, right? And what does this mean for the 2018 elections? What are the hopes of the Democrats, and can they be fulfilled in this election year? Stay with us. We'll be right back with our panelists.
This is Brother Cornell West, and you are listening to Sojourner Truth with host, my dear sister, Margaret Prescott.
Home is where the hatred is. Home is filled with pain, and it might not be such a bad idea if I never went home again.
And that song is Home is Where the Hatred Is, and the artist is Gil Scott-Heron. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. If you've missed any part of this hour, for 10 this morning, for 90 days after that, just go to kpfk.org, scroll down to archives, click on Sojourner Truth. You'll be able to hear the show in its entirety, and you can subscribe for a free podcast. You can check us out on our website at www.sotrueradio.org, where you could also get all of our back shows are archived there. And if you're a member of Facebook, like and friend us on Facebook. We would like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in the Great Island Nation, the first Black Republic of Haiti. We now return to our weekly roundtable. Our panelists are Laura Carlson, Jackie Goldberg, and Dr. Gerald Horn. this proposal of work requirements for Medicaid, which covers more than 70 million people in the United States. And on Thursday, the Trump administration announced that they would allow states to deny Medicaid coverage to individuals who would otherwise be eligible but are not in the waged workforce. This is, of course, the approach that they've used with people on welfare, with Clinton's welfare reform. Let us go now to a short clip of people who would be impacted by this.
Texarkana is a twin city that straddles the Texas and Arkansas state border. Residents on one side of town can get coverage through Medicaid expansion, while those on the other side of town cannot.
Is there a stereotype around here that if you're on Medicaid, then you don't have a job?
You're either lazy or on drugs, or I mean, there's a stereotype.
I miss working.
Oh, really?
I miss getting up in the morning.
None of us want to live off of government assistance.
You've all worked.
Years and years.
I've been working since I was 18 years old. When I got diagnosed with breast cancer, it was either I continue working or I stopped working to get this surgery.
This is the first I ever been off of work because I took sick.
If you guys could get health insurance, you could go back to work like you want to.
Nobody asked to be in this position. You know, I'm only 37 years old. I never seen any breast cancer coming my way.
I'm 40 years old. I would never see myself going through this situation. And it hurts when you don't get help.
And so much of getting through cancer or any of these conditions is your attitude. And if you're constantly having to worry about getting treatment, being able not to worry about getting my treatments paid for anymore, that left me time to have a good attitude and be strong and get through it.
Yes, you know, that the source, by the way, is CNN for that clip. But Laura Carlson, when you think things can't get any worse, they do. This is an election year, 2020. Here you have these poor women, because impoverished people have been so dehumanized, you know, that people don't think that they have a right to welfare or that they have a right to Medicare, and that they always have to make some excuse and say, well, I would really be out there working, as though what they're doing in the home, likely taking care of their families or taking care of themselves and their community, isn't work. But Laura Carlson, just your comment on that, and also on the 2018 midterms, your views on these midterms, and if, you know, how do you think the 2018 will play out, Laura Carlson?
First of all, this is a right, and we can't lose sight of this. People have a right to live in a society where, as we saw from the clip, they have worked hard. They have paid their dues, so to speak. And that's what taxes are for. Again, this ties back to the border issue in the sense that people have lost track, in a way, both Democrats and Republicans, of a sense of priority, and that public spending there are trade-offs. When they talk about throwing $18 billion at the wall just in order to get what is common human decency of the permanence of DACA students and workers here in the United States, they're forgetting that this $18 billion is needed for these kinds of programs that guarantee a level of living, a level of humanity within our communities. What they're saying is that the waiver, in order to require work for Medicaid, requires that there's a health and work link and that it furthers the objectives of Medicaid. But every study we've seen shows that there's negative health consequences of a work requirement. And then 60% already work. So it's just creating this whole bureaucracy and set of obstacles to just basic need of access to health care. And then there's 30% who are caring for young children. So we're talking about a measure that has very clear discriminatory impact against women and against societies that still don't see caring for young children as work. And so the impact could be terrible. But in overall, we're talking about the way that we see our society. And this does, in fact, feed into the issue of the 2018 midterm elections. there's a very real possibility that we could see a Democratic surge here, I think. And we're beginning to see the signs of it with important individuals like Ethan Royce in California leaving. The Democrats need 24 or some reports say 25 additional seats. There's a possibility that that could happen in the House. Of course, it's much more difficult in the Senate. But last spring, when we went through the border area and went through the state of California with the caravan against fear, we spent a lot of time in different offices, particularly in Orange County. And that's where it's interesting, since Orange County was always kind of synonymous with hardcore Republican base of support, it's interesting to see the real possibilities of flipping there. Now, California has never been, an indicator of the country at large, but it's certainly a very important political state.
Yeah.
And there we are seeing real possibilities to flip. So I think that there's hope for these midterm elections. People are associated, they don't want to lose, and that's why they're leaving their seats. And they think they could lose, and they really could. And there's a real fear that Trump's going to take them all down.
Yeah.
And any association with this madman is a political liability.
Right. Thank you, Laura Carlson. Jackie Goldberg, the Democrats need 47 seats for majority. That's quite a few seats there to flip. Of course, in the Senate, they just need one. In Nevada, Republican Senator Dean Heller seems to be one. That one possibility for a flip. But then you have people like Sheriff Joe Arpaio in Arizona running on the ticket. Just Jackie Goldberg, your thoughts on both this workfare for Medicaid and the possibilities for the Democrats in 2018.
Well, workfare for Medicaid is a very cruel notion. Because generally speaking, the people who sign up for Medicaid are people who can't get health care any other way. And we're looking at states like Arizona, Arkansas, Indiana, Kansas, Kentucky, Maine, New Hampshire, North Carolina, Utah, and Wisconsin. They have already asked for a relief from Trump of just giving it to them, so they want to have people have to work. The results of looking at people working for Medicaid, first of all, it will affect very few people on Medicaid because certainly if you're in a nursing home, which is the largest number of people in Medicaid, you're not going to be going out to work. If you're disabled, it's going to be a lot harder. If you've been permanently unemployed because you've been looking for work and can't find it. But here's the real lie. The real lie is that most of the people who are young and on Medicaid are working. They're either working full-time or part-time, and they can't get any kind of health benefits from where they're working. So that's a big part of the problem. I think it is part of the election strategy of Trump to say that, we have welfare cheats, we have too many non-white people coming into the country, to begin to try to, he's ginning up the white racist reaction to believing that anybody who isn't doing as well as you are, there must be something that they're doing wrong, that there's something bad about them. They're wrong and bad. And I think that's the general Republican kind of discussion right now about who lives in the United States. You don't need a safety net. People don't need a safety net because if they were doing what they were supposed to be doing instead of taking drugs or having too many babies or whatever the mythology is, then you wouldn't. Everybody would be able to afford health care, or they'd get it from their employer. So that's the lie. How this is going to work, I think we have a less of a chance of taking the Senate than the House, which sounds odd since we only need one or two seats in the Senate. But this particular year, remember, only a third of the Senate is elected every 2 years. And this particular year, the great bulk of the people in the Senate that are up for election are Democrats, not Republicans. That makes this a lot harder time. However, turnout will make the difference. If, in fact, what we saw in Virginia, what we saw in Alabama, what we saw other places is that we really focus on turning out the people, the diverse group of people who voted in the Obama elections, I think it is possible but unlikely that we'll take back the Senate. On the other hand, I think we're beginning to see with 31 retirements of Republican incumbents, even though some of them are in very Republican districts, some of them aren't. Some of them are like ISIS and like Royce, who both decided to step down in California just the other day, are a part of 31 people who are strategic and saying, look, I'm going to have to raise a lot of money. I might lose. Why don't I just go out on a high? I'll get my retirement. I'll get my health care for the rest of my life. I'll be paid for the rest of my life, a good retirement from working in the Congress. Let's get out of here. Let somebody else do that. That means for, in California and many other places, an opportunity, because even in a Republican district, in a midterm election with a Republican governor, a Republican president, the turnout gap, it drops to almost zero, like one percentage point, whereas when there's a Democrat in the White House, the turnout for Republicans' advantage is about 6 points.
Yeah.
And that's where the difference will be, is that there's not only a Republican president, but a very unpopular Republican president.
Right.
And he continues to be unpopular in spite of the fact that he got some great things done from his point of view. So I think the big question will be, I think it's very likely, I'm gonna go out on a limb and say I think it's very likely that the Democrats will recapture the House.
Okay.
I think it's less likely that we'll get the Senate back, just because of the number of senators that are Democrats that
right.
are up for election, as opposed to the number of Republicans.
Okay, so some news there by Jackie Goldberg. And Dr. Gerald Horn, on the Senate side, I mean, CNN is saying there are about 8 Senate seats that may flip to the Republican. I mean, and Claire McCaskill in Missouri, Joe Donnelly, Indiana, Joe Manchin in West Virginia, Heidi Henkamp in North Dakota, Sherrod Brown, Ohio, John Tester, Montana, Tammy Baldwin, Wisconsin, Bill Nelson in Florida. So, you know, Jackie does have a point there. But your thoughts on this Medicaid for Work, as well as your views on the 2018 midterms, because you still have a whole sector of the left that will sit out the election because they're totally opposed to anybody in the so-named political class. But then what are we left with? Some final thoughts from you, Dr. Horn.
Well, I think California has a major role to play, not only with regard to the forced retirement of ISA and Royce, but also Kevin McCarthy, who's part of the GOP House leadership, needs to be targeted, along with Mimi Walters, who I think is vulnerable in Southern California. There have been recent court cases, too, for example, in North Carolina, where a federal court just ruled that there was gerrymandering in terms of drawing in congressional districts that could lead, possibly, to more Republicans being replaced. The Supreme Court obviously will be ruling on that kind of principle soon, which also will help to tell the tale. I think with regard to these elections, a lot of it depends upon what model is pursued. If you look at the defeat of Roy Moore recently in the state of Alabama, it was not so much due to the Democratic National Committee's efforts. It was really due to independent black efforts to turn out the black vote, particularly through Black PAC. And if the DNC was smart, they'd direct more money towards the black press, towards formations like Black PAC, et cetera. With regard to this work fair or work to get Medicaid, Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House, made it clear after the tax bill was passed that the next target would be the social welfare system, because the premise would be that the government coffers have now been weakened and the money is now available, so they say, not to subsidize Medicare, Medicaid, and all of the rest. That'll be the next major battle that we'll face in 2018. But that in itself obscures the larger question, which is that with the rise of artificial intelligence and robotization, there's obviously going to have to be a move to a guaranteed annual wage, which already is taking place in Scandinavia. But the United States is going to be handicapped in doing so because racism helps to prevent that logical move.
Right. Well, on that note, Dr. Horn, we are going to have to leave it there. Another fascinating roundtable. Thank all of you. If you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. Today's show produced by myself, Margaret Prescott. Thank the Sojourner Truth team, our intern Sherelle Withers, assistant producer Stephanie Case, our engineer Teddy Robinson. And we want to say our hearts go out to our listeners, but everybody in the area impacted by the mudslides. 18 people killed. I think 8 people still missing. So you are in our thoughts. Thank you for listening.
Have you heard? KBOO hosts Beloved Community in Action movie nights every third Thursday at 7 p.m. here at the radio station. In January, we'll show the movie The Mask You Live In, a documentary that follows boys and young men as they struggle to stay true to themselves while negotiating America's narrow definition of masculinity. Again, that's a screening of The Mask You Live In for the KBOO Beloved Community in Action movie night on Thursday, January 18th at 7 p.m. at KBOO, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at KBOO.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the new member orientation for the Urban League of Portland Young Professionals on Monday, January 22nd at 5 p.m. at the Kennedy School in Portland. Learn about the history of the Urban League and the Young Professional Committee, the activities of each of the groups, and how you can get involved. Again, that's the new member orientation for the Urban League of Portland Young Professionals, Monday, January 22nd at 5 p.m. in the Community Room at the Kennedy School, 5736 Northeast 33rd Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning, it's 9:59, and here's what we have coming up for the rest of the morning here at KBOO. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein, and then at 11 o'clock, The Food Show with host Chris Siegel. Please stay tuned to KBOO for all this and much more coming up. And remember that KBOO keeps you informed, and you can be an owner down here if you go to kboo.fm and click where it says Donate. You can become a member and join us in your efforts to defeat the really disgusting paradigm that's happening here. Let's listen to a little music before Air Cascadia. Thank you.